Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is the chairman of the Department of Medicine at Stanford and the former American Heart Association president, Bob Harrington. So for this episode, we have Dr. Robert Harrington, or Bob as people often call him. He's the chair of the Department of Medicine at Stanford and the former American Heart Association president. And he shares what it means to be the chair of a large academic department, what it means to get there as an academic clinician and interventional cardiologist. And he chats a bit about what it means to be the president of a prominent medical nonprofit organization. Bob is an incredible human being. I'm so thankful to have him. And I will just briefly share his resume. He has authored over 600 papers, book chapters, editorials, etc. He was on the editorial board of the Journal of American College of Cardiology and the former deputy editor of JAMA Cardiology. He's got his own podcast, The Bob Harrington Show, on Medscape. And he has a really big Twitter following. I hope you guys enjoy this episode. Bob, for our listeners, can you share a little bit about what your day-to-day involves as a Department of Medicine chair? I feel like that's a pretty common thing that trainees hear about, but I don't think we know too much about what the job actually involves.
What the chair actually does. So
yeah, what do you guys do? What do you guys do?
Yeah, so we'll take Stanford as the microcosm of American medicine when I describe the role, because most departments of medicine have similar structures across the United States and the chairs have similar jobs. Although at every place there's going to be some specificity that's unique to that place. And so I'll tell you when I'm talking, I think specifically about Stanford and then I'll tell you when I think they're more generalizable. But from a Stanford perspective, the Department of Medicine is the largest department in the university. We're actually larger than every school within the university, with the exception of the School of Medicine, of which we're part. We are a department of 15 divisions. 12 of those divisions have clinical missions in addition to the research and education mission, and 3 of those divisions have no clinical activity associated with them. So a very diverse group of divisions. And, you know, internal medicine and its constituent subspecialties, this would look the same across the country with some subtle differences, for example, where some divisions may have been combined to make a single larger division. But, you know, we have 3 cancer divisions, for example, and some places have 1 cancer division with oncology, hematology, and blood marrow transplantation all part of the same entity. Here we have 3 separate ones. We have cardiology and primary care and hospital medicine, pulmonary critical care, et cetera. I don't want to leave anybody out, so I'll just say et cetera. So there's 15 divisions. Those 15 divisions have almost 650 faculty. Those 15 divisions have 400 plus trainees, people like you, but also fellows, postdocs, et cetera. And then there's about 1,000 staff who support those 600 plus faculty and 400 plus trainees. So overall, the Department of Medicine is about 2,000 people. And my job is to have ultimate responsibility for the clinical activities, the research activities, and the educational activities of all of those groups. But you might imagine that that only happens because there's various other levels of leadership that really, as I say, do the work. And my job is to sort of keep us all aligned, keep us moving in an appropriate direction, and keep us aligned with the greater mission of the Stanford School of Medicine and then ultimately Stanford Medicine.
That's amazing. What do you feel prepared you most for this job? I know oftentimes in academia you get promoted, a little bit based on how much you may have published, how much research you have done. Do you feel like that translates into this role academically, or have you found maybe your clinical experiences or other experiences prepare you the most?
That is really a very insightful question, because you're absolutely right. Historically, division chiefs, department chairs, deans arrived in those positions on the basis of some success in a specific domain, whether it's research, clinical medicine, but it was really around their individual success. I think more recently, people have realized that running a department of medicine is really running a business. I mean, our annual budget is in excess of $400 million a year. And the expectation is that you can manage that $400 million a year. And the same would be true of the other 16 clinical department chairs here at Stanford, things like surgery, OBGYN, pediatrics, et cetera. And so what prepares you for it? Certainly not being a doctor and not being a researcher. And people, I think, learn how to do these jobs by having had a series of successive roles where they were asked to assume more and more responsibility. So let's take me. You know, I began my career, as you said, as an interventional cardiologist at Duke, where I had done my fellowship training, and as a member of what was then called the Duke Data Bank for Cardiovascular Diseases, where I had done my research training. So I started life as a clinical researcher and interventional cardiologist. My clinical activity in those days was broad. I did interventional cardiology. I attended in the intensive care unit. I attended on general cardiology. I did cardiology consults. I did outpatient clinics. I did a lot of different things. But then and then I was a researcher. And for most of my career at Duke, I spent half my time doing research and half my time doing clinical medicine. As my research became more successful, I actually became, I assumed a series of leadership positions largely focused on research and ultimately on the organization of research. And I had said I started my career in what was called the Duke Data Bank. And I moved ultimately as the data bank morphed into a larger entity at Duke called the Duke Clinical Research Institute. I had a series of leadership roles within that structure that culminated in me becoming the director of the Duke Clinical Research Institute. And that is probably where I really learned how both to lead and to manage a big structure. So my research group, when I left Duke, had 1,200 people in it and had an annual research budget of about $180 to $200 million. And so I was really responsible for organizing it in a way that would allow the faculty and staff at Duke who were doing those research projects to do their work. And I learned that you really have to have teams around you that are the experts. So in my role at Duke, I came from the science realm. What did I know about finance? And what did I know about HR? And what did I know about operations? And so I had a chief operating officer, I had a chief financial officer, I had a chief of human resources, I had a chief of business development, all of whom reported to me. And then on the other side of the matrix, so think about it as matrix management, were all the scientists, the leaders of cardiology, the leaders of GI, the leaders of pediatrics. And they reported to me really more scientifically. And so it's the business professionals on one side of the matrix, the science leaders on the other side of the matrix, and they need to really work well together to get the job done. And so when I was asked to look at the Stanford Department of Medicine job, and this really differentiates, I think, Stanford, I had never been a division chief. I had never led a clinical program. I was a clinical research director. But Stanford somehow saw that as a set of skills that might be transferable to this job.
That's really insightful for trainees and maybe even those who are a little more progressive in their training. What questions do you think they should ask themselves for whether they would thrive in such a role or whether they would enjoy such a role or would make sense for them? And what experiences do you think might they be have access to gain those extra clinical experiences that provided you preparation for the job that you have now?
Yeah, I think that some people, maybe myself included, enjoy the leadership piece. They enjoy setting the direction for a group or an entity. They enjoy thinking about how to create a vision, how to motivate people, how to get people working together in a way for the common good, if you will. And I think that the way your listeners might think about this as they advance their own careers is start small. If you're trying to see if you have both an appetite and an aptitude for leadership, is to take on some leadership roles. Now that may be, you know, just start leading a project. That's what I did. I led clinical trials projects. I led clinical research projects, where you're required to bring together a team with different skill sets than yours and deliver on that product. In my case, it would be deliver a clinical research project. But people can come from laboratory science where they're, you know, delivering a set of experiments that required bringing 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 people together to do that. And you have to decide, do you like doing that? Do you like being the person who has to set the agenda, the person who has to think about how this fits into the larger whole of the organization, et cetera? And you got to get experience. And I would say there's a couple of levels of experience. One is the true hands-on, which is you learn to be a leader by leading, and have a series of successfully larger leadership opportunities. But there's also skill things that you can take classes, you can go to courses. So I hire those 15 division chiefs. Those are the 15 people who report to me. And in addition to some vice chairs who are what I'll call subject matter experts in broader topics like education, clinical research, basic science research. And all of the leaders that we hire, we offer a variety of leadership opportunities. Take courses, take classes. There's stuff offered at Stanford, for example. There's things offered nationally. And then for others, and this was a direction that I went, is that I employ the services of an executive coach. And I've worked with the same executive coach for 12 to 13 years now. And she has helped me enormously in terms of developing my own leadership skills. And if you look at the corporate world, this whole notion of an executive coach is actually pretty common. It's more recent in academic medicine, but increasingly I find that a lot of my counterparts across the country are looking to an executive coach to help them develop their leadership skills. I mean, there's a discipline to it, right? That you got to learn the skills. You got to learn to have difficult conversations. You've got to learn to manage people. You've got to learn on a practical basis how to manage a budget. You have to learn how to understand the P&L. You have to understand all of those topics, and I have to spend time on all of those.
Yeah. So to dig a little deeper there, how would you describe your typical day? What do you most look forward to, and what gives you more headaches and keeps you up at night?
So, you know, and it's almost like we could frame this in COVID and pre-COVID and what I hope will be a post-COVID state. So essentially my job involves, I would say, broadly, four domains. I am a clinician first, and I will always think of myself as a clinical doctor first. In fact, if you met me, let's say at a cocktail party and we were talking, you would say, Bob, what do you do? And I would say, I'm a doctor. And it might take a long time before I get to I'm a chair of medicine. Because that's not my first identity. My first identity is identification is as a doctor. So I'm a clinical doctor, and I no longer practice interventional cardiology, but I practice general cardiology, and I attend on the general cardiology service, inpatient service here at Stanford, and I have a weekly clinic, half-day clinic for cardiology. And I see general cardiology patients, both in the inpatient setting and the outpatient setting. Now, I see patients maybe 10, 15% of the time. Contrast that to my former job at Duke, where even when I was the research director, I saw patients 30% of the time. In most of my career, I saw patients half of my time. So I see patients. I still do research in the area of cardiovascular medicine. And here's where the Stanford job, I think, is a little different than a lot of places. A lot of my counterparts at other places have largely given up their research career to concentrate on the administrative issues. Some haven't, but I haven't. I spend anywhere from 25 to 35% of my time doing cardiovascular related research that is really important to me. And then the rest of my time I spend, I'll put mentoring under my administrative role. I spend a lot of time mentoring my division chiefs, mentoring faculty. There's a small group of trainees, largely fellows, that I continue to mentor. And then I have a variety of administrative tasks that I need to make sure get done. I have to represent the Department of Medicine at a variety of meetings around campus. I represent the School of Medicine at a variety of things across campus. So administrative still takes up the large portion of my time, but research next and clinical medicine last, but certainly not least, in terms of how many hours a week I spend.
Yeah. And it sounds like you derive a lot of fulfillment from your research and your clinical practice. So
my office, pre-COVID, my office would always know when it was my clinic day, because they said it was the day I smiled the most, when I got to put my white coat on and head over to my clinic or up to the hospital to see patients. It's the thing I like doing the best. A close second is doing research. I love doing research. I love talking about research. I love talking about research problems, solving research problems. And I wouldn't say that I have a natural aptitude for administration, but I know that there's things that have to get done for the department to function. And so I do them. But largely what my job is at this point is to delegate a lot of responsibility to other people and then to oversee their work and to help them get their work done when they need it.
Bob, you're too humble. You're too humble. And do you feel like your administrative roles sort of help you derive more joy out of your clinical and research roles? Do you feel like if you just did clinical, if you just did research, or you just did administrative, you could be more burnt out? Do you feel like having this variety allows you to thrive in each domain more?
That is another really insightful question. And not for me personally, the answer is yes, is that if I had to do any one thing, I think I would derive less joy than having the opportunity to do these many things. Now, not everybody's personality would say that about them, right? Some people really like to go very deep into a single thing. That's not my personality. I prefer sort of the broad range of opportunities and activities that keep it interesting. I mean, so, you know, if you look at my schedule today, it started off very early this morning with a series of phone calls that largely dealt with other clinical departments, the dean's office. Then I got to break to go to medical grand rounds, which was an awesome medical grand rounds today. And from there, I got to go to a brainstorming meeting about digital health with two of our divisions that are trying to do interesting digital health products and projects in the outpatient setting. From there, I then had a series of meetings with individual division chiefs for check-in, mentorship, et cetera. And now I get to talk to you, and it's only 11 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning here in California, and I've already had a pretty fun day. I'm going to spend the next couple of hours reviewing papers for the American Heart Association that have to be approved next week by the board of directors, and I have to present them to them in a way that they can understand it. So that'll be fun. So yeah, I have a great day.
That's
amazing.
I get
to do a lot of different stuff. Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible. That's actually a good segue, because you were just the president of the American Heart Association. We hear about these incredible associations and the roles they have in academia, sort of create a family, I think, within a discipline. But what does it mean to be the president of an organization like the American Heart Association? And how did you find yourself in that role?
So, yeah, the AHA has been an important part, as you say. I think you used the word family or something, or it's, it really is my main professional home. I mean, most cardiologists, we belong to two organizations and then some smaller organizations, but the two major organizations that clinical cardiologists, clinical researchers belong to are the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. And I've had a great home in the two of those places. The American College of Cardiology is really the professional society. That's where the members and the members' needs are really attended to, around education, around advocacy for things like reimbursement and billing and things like that. So it's really the professional organization that I'm a member of. The American Heart Association is a lot different. The American Heart Association is really my research and education home. It is an organization. It's not a professional society. It's a public health charity. It has 40 million volunteers of people who do things that you're probably familiar with. I don't know, growing up, if you did things like jump rope for heart.
Of course.
Yep. Jump rope for heart is a way to get kids understanding heart disease and also to understand the importance of raising money that then can be invested into research. The Heart Association is the second largest funder, not-for-profit funder of heart and stroke research in this country, second only to the federal government, the NIH. Wow. So the AHA, now I'm talking a lot pre-COVID, the AHA in an average year would fund $180 million of research, new research grants. And at any one time, the Heart Association has about $500 million worth of research obligations. So it really is a research-oriented organization. But it also has a big advocacy platform with advocacy offices in Washington, D.C. And the only public health charity that has, or health-related charity that has registered lobbyists in all 50 states. So we lobby for things like taxes on sugary sweetened beverages. We lobby to try to protect America's youth from vaping products. We lobby for access to fruits and vegetables in certain communities that are so-called food deserts. Within the Heart Association, within that 40 million volunteers who do heart walks and heart balls and all that stuff, there's 40,000 science volunteers, people like me. And there's 16 science councils that we're members of. And my two home councils are the Council on Clinical Cardiology, which is the largest, and something called QCOR, which is a group dealing with cardiovascular outcomes and quality research. And it was those two councils that nominated me to be president and then went through that process, et cetera. But I've been a volunteer at the Heart Association since I was a cardiology fellow, now for the last 30 years. And so I've played a series of roles through the Heart Association. I've chaired the annual scientific meeting. I've written a lot of papers on behalf of the Heart Association. And I was a science member of the board, and then I became the president. So it was a real privilege.
Is that a full-time job in its own right in some ways? Or is that or is that something that you're able to complement into your other work?
Yeah, there's a full-time staff led by a highly professional organization, including a highly professional CEO who run the Heart Association. I tell people that the president's job is to be the face and the voice of science to the public and to be the voice of science back to the board of directors. Because the board of directors is mainly business people. And the chair of the board is a businessman. This particular year is a businessman. And the job of the president is really to be the voice of science on the board so that the board is hearing about, well, what does it mean to talk about heart attacks and strokes? And, you know, why should we be doing this in research? And why should we be raising this money for, the, you know, for these programs? And that's the job. Is it a full-time job as the president? No, it's a job that you're constantly thinking about. So in that sense, maybe it's fully in my brain all the time, but it probably took 20 to 25% of my effort over the year. And that effort largely came from my research time, as opposed to my administrative time. So I didn't do less at Stanford. I probably did less of my own research during that last year. But it was a great honor, and I had a lot of fun, and I met a lot of interesting people, and I got to do some things that were sort of once in a lifetime events.
Yeah, and you also have always had a voice in cardiology. You're on Twitter. I think you have something like 14, 15,000 followers. You also have a podcast, like we were saying too. So I'm sure that was already very valuable to create a voice for the AHA, or to sort of have that scientific platform already established. Do you recommend, or I would maybe phrase this other way, for what type of person would you recommend to build out or try to have more of a social media presence? What about your own interests do you think keeps you going on Twitter regularly with your interviews? What type of qualities and characteristics do you think would allow somebody to thrive and build something from there, as we sort of discuss the different paths one can take within medicine and academia too?
I'm somebody who likes to discuss ideas. So I like forums where I can discuss and debate and argue about ideas. I think that's how progress is made. I'm also somebody, and I think that my leadership roles have helped me understand this, that I think that all of us learn in different ways. And so while I'm doing research, which I'll call the foundational content of my discussions, I've also realized that my research ideas and my viewpoints are only going to be read by a really small audience. Even a prestigious publication like the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, it's got limited reach, because that's not how people get their information. And I realized that a long time ago, and I established my Twitter account more than a decade ago. And I saw it as an opportunity to engage in a public discourse that was different than my going to meetings or my going to conferences, et cetera. And that in many ways I could both broaden my reach, but also broaden how I got my own information. And so that's why I did it. And I enjoy being on Twitter. I keep up with a lot of the medical literature that way. I keep up with some interesting debates. What I would recommend for people, if that's a forum you want to use, is decide what your persona is going to be and stick with it. The people who end up having a lot of followers is because you're acknowledged as somebody in an area that people want to hear from. And so while I'm a Department of Medicine chair, but my Twitter account is largely about cardiology. As you said, my tag on Twitter is at HeartBobH. And so I'm telling people, I'm talking about the heart. Do I bring other stuff in? Yeah, and people who follow me on Twitter know what I'm interested in. I talk about my family. I talk about the Red Sox. I talk about working in my vineyard. And I post a lot of pictures of the crazy socks I wear with red hearts on them and things like that. But that's my persona. There's like, I'm not out there about a lot of other things. Everything kind of is tied to heart disease, heart health, because that's what I want to talk about.
Right, right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for this discussion. I thought it was incredibly engaging. I learned a lot. You've been so gracious with the mentorship you've provided to so many people, and I hope those listening will be able to get something out of this discussion. I really appreciate your time.
I you're doing a great job with this, and I'm excited to hear how it develops over time. I think there's an important role for these sorts of discussions, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some of the things that I do. So thank you very much.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.